unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kappas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good morning. Welcome, everyone. My name's Linda. Is there anyone here for the first time? Oh, lots of people. Wonderful. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming. Hope you find what you're looking for here. So I want to say, first of all, Mushum was supposed to give the talk today, and some of you have asked, so I want to let you know, Mushum is fine. She's not unwell. Things arose in her life, and she was not able to come at the last minute. She will be speaking in late June, so we'll let you know then. So, very early yesterday morning, there was a fire in Tassajara, and the Zendo burned down completely. So, for those of you who are new, Tassajara is the San Francisco Zen Center monastery in the mountains, just inland of Big Sur. And it's been a practice place for many, many people here and elsewhere around the world. And it's a very deeply treasured place. So as I speak of it, you might consider it as any place that you have loved deeply and profoundly, not only as a place, but as a place of being with other people who are deeply meaningful to you and with whom you share a life and vows, and all of you together are both your best and your worst selves, and you can get through the times of being the worst because of our vows together. The rest of Tassajara is completely fine. And I also wanted to say the announcement that I sent out from Mako on the listserv mentioned that the cause was man-made, in quotes, which just basically means it wasn't caused by lightning or other natural, well, it was, we think. Several of us believe that there was a semi-natural cause. The fire started in the attic, and there's a lot of wood rats that live up there, and it was just, the electrical was just a Romex cable, which they can chew through rather easily. So somehow there was a spark, and it started and spread. And I guess it was Myoju who first noticed it around midnight and went and roused everyone. And you know, David Zimmerman is leading the practice period down there now. And by the way, this was day 7 of their sesshin, day 7 of an 8-day sesshin. So everybody's like in this very tender, open space, and suddenly like coming together around this. And David was a fire monk many years ago. The Basin Complex fire. So he was leading the practice period, which, you know, and his cabin is right next to the Zendo. So I guess Mako said he was going in and out of the Zendo, carrying things out before it got too bad. And my own sense is, you know, and they'd put a metal roof on the Zendo some years ago as fire protection, but in this case, it didn't allow the heat to escape. So it burned incredibly hot, and there's nothing. There's nothing. Except those little concrete blocks that you put foundations in. There's neat little rows of those. And the face of the Buddha, just the face, is in the middle of ash and rubble. But the rest of the Buddha did not make it. It was just too hot, too dispersed. So And I went to the Shuso ceremony yesterday at City Center. So I got to see like so many people from San Francisco Zen Center and Mako, fire monk. Mako and David are both now abbots of San Francisco Zen Center. Mako was there because David's down there, she's up here. And already people were talking about, you know, it's like so much grief, loss, depends on kind of how long you've been around, because many people remember this Zendo, which was the new temporary Zendo that was built in 1978 after, or 77 or 78, after the original Zendo burned down. So, you know, and in Japan, I mean, for hundreds of, you know, until recently, everything was built out of wood and paper. So fires were frequent and rebuilt. It's the same temple, but we're going to rebuild it. So people who are more senior were already talking about like rebuilding and fundraising, what we're going to do, and just very practical things. I guess a lot of people, I guess everybody lost their bowls, their Orioki bowls, because it was during Sashina in there. Although they won't need them for the summer, you know. But some people had their rakusus, a few okasis, but mostly rakusus on the back of the Ngawa stored there. So already people are thinking about how can we sew people new robes. So, and along with that, I'd been texting yesterday with a friend who's currently in Japan. And she wrote to me yesterday after hearing about this. I used to be obsessed with an Annie DeFranco song that started, "I am out here studying stones, trying to learn to be less alive." This song popped into my head suddenly this morning after she'd heard the news. But I looked up and realized that the trees reminded me so much of that old tree behind the Zendo in front of the library that I fear is lost today. I remember in the winter of 2017 studying with such complete wonder how these ancient gnarled branches could produce tiny buds and then flowers. From where in that seemingly dead branch does this life spring? It's always together. It's always together. You know, I think all faces of the Buddha have this very gentle smile, like this. And when I saw that picture, you know, this smile is intact, and you know, there's some damage around the face, but still there. Buddha is still there. Buddha has not gone away. You know, here, there, this, cup, Buddha. Another friend wrote and offered that a monk visiting Japan told someone concerned about the first Tassajara fire and learning, losing the Zendo, just said, pointed at the altar, Buddha, then pointed at the ashes, Buddha, and pointed at the woman who asked, Buddha. And we all know this isn't easy. You know, I mean, this is why we practice, so that we can have some space to hold that. And another friend wrote about a talk that Sojin had given many years ago about impermanence in response to some event like this. And in the Q&A, a student was distressed at the fragility of the circumstances they were in at the time. She said, Sojin said in a very strong voice, it's all right. it has to be all right if all of this place, Berkeley Zen Center, burns down tomorrow. And he saw all the distressed faces in the Zendo, and he said, that's right, it has to be all right. So everything changes. The practice will continue. Our practice is not dependent on circumstances. But how do we understand Sojin's words, it has to be all right, or it is all right? That's really important. Because some things we know aren't all right. So how can we hold all right and not all right together in a whole way, in a wholehearted way, in a whole-bodied way? Not having our very tender, painful human feelings just take us over completely, or at least if they come and take us over completely, to not give them solidity and try to make them permanent, or to not think they're permanent, or to not act out of some idea of permanence. This is the koan of being a human being, of being alive, is how do we hold this both and together? This, you know, what looks like permanence. I wake up as myself every morning and I recognize each of you and, you know, you're reliably there, and this place is reliably here. This is part of my permanent world. And yet everything changes, sometimes slowly and sometimes faster than we can take in. At the Shuso ceremony yesterday, the three main themes that kept coming up, because they were clearly they were things that the Shuso had spoken about during the practice period, were fear, vulnerability, and tenderness. And the theme of the, I don't know about the theme of the practice period, but what was deeply worked into it was practice in the body, being in the body. And of course, this is, you know, this is the heart of our practice. This is a body practice. How do we live in this precious, tender, fragile, vulnerable human body? With all that happens, you know, with all that we experience, and stay open and tender in the positive sense, not closing down, but staying open. So today is the third No Kings Day. Somehow this seemed to me like the perfect transition here. I was just gonna talk about things related to that, and then this happened yesterday, so. But this is our lives, right? We had some plan and then something happens. Something big or small, or it's not working the way we thought it would as of yesterday. And a couple days ago, I was out on Russell Street and I heard all this honking, and I was like really wondering what's all the honking going on, like down by Russell and MLK. And I was going for a walk, so I walked down there, and there's this tiny, joyful little protest. There were like seven or eight people on each side of the street, many of them older. And they were, one woman had a little amplifier and a guitar, and she was singing folk songs. which was, you know, and people had signs that said something like, honk if you support peaceful protest. Everyone was honking. And I wanted to honk too, but I couldn't. So when I got close to them, I just yelled, honk, honk. And I felt so uplifted and my heart opened. And as I continued walking down the street, I burst into tears. Just with the openness and the all of itness. I did not used to be able to do that. I did not used to be able to cry. Now it just happens really easily, but it's just like, it's like thunderstorms rather than an atmospheric river that's parked over you, you know, every once in 10 years or something. And I'm so grateful for this practice that I can allow the passing thunderstorms to come through. And still somewhat embarrassed by them, but not so much anymore. I don't really care. But it was something about, you know, this, it's like just these people coming out. I guess it was organized through, or they organized through Indivisible. But just these people coming out and just doing something and doing it together. And bringing joy and kindness and not an ounce of anger. Yeah. And because I've been thinking about all of this for some time now, specifically my own role as abbot, you know, what's my role within the Sangha in terms of what's going on in the world? How do I support all of you? What is my role? What is Berkeley Zen Center's role? I've been talking with the Berkeley Zen Center board about this as well. You know, like, how does this work? You know, okay, so I'm abbot now, so I can sign things for myself. It's going to be like signed on behalf of Berkeley Zen Center, then we need to check it out. But yeah, I was just feeling my way, but I had too many thoughts, too many ideas. There was too much input. Every day brought additional new input, which was not always helpful, you know, just like the news. Thoughts about like how to deal with things, approaches, what you can do, what's useful, what's useless, what's effective, what's not. Everybody has their own ideas. And as I just felt my way, you know, in my body, into all of that, I realized that I needed to ground in my own clarity, my own understanding, my own view, my own vision. And I realized that for me, whatever I do needs to be completely grounded in Dharma. And of course, there are many, many ways to do that. But that feels to me as a Sangha, like regardless of what anyone's doing individually, to do it with the mind of practice makes a difference. And you know, Dogen said once, I think it was in the Tenzo Kyokan, about how the head cook practices, the practice of the head cook. And he said, and this was put up in the city center kitchen for many years, it may still be there. Said, if you don't have a mind of the way, all this hard work is just useless. So that's not about external circumstances. That's about one's own practice, clearly, because many things can be effective in the world, even though you're suffering and the people around you are suffering to make it happen. just occurred to me. Parents probably experience this a lot. Like, you give all out for your kids, and it may not all, you may not always have a mind of practice, but you're just working to help your kid grow up, you know, and to be solid as a person as much as they can be. But how do we hold all of that together? So mostly what I've been reflecting on is that I only know where I am right now. And then I have conversations with some people about what their own view is or what their world is. So I'm aware that there are a number, you know, that there are many people in the Sangha who are active in working for peace in the world, for democracy, for many, many things. And I'm aware that some of those people don't particularly want that to be something that's talked about here from the Dharma seat, because for them, Berkeley Zen Center is a place of refuge. It's a place to be restored and encouraged and to take a little break from that because their lives are deeply involved in this kind of work. And others want Berkeley, you know, and some people want Berkeley Zen Center to be like really directly involved, really out there. And some people, this it just isn't a something they really want to hear about, you know. They have other affinities, and everyone has their own affinities. And I don't know that we can hold them all together at one time, but I'm really exploring how do we hold all of this together? You know, how do we hold together as a Sangha? It's taken me years to hold all the different parts of myself together as a whole, and you know, the forms and the place and the practice go such a long way toward doing that. But I really want to hear more from all of you in a variety of ways, because I only have this one person's ideas, and I learn so much in dialogue with other people, hearing other people's experience, hearing other people's views and actions and where they've learned from. For me, that's what makes relationship and Sangha so alive. So a lot of the things I had planned to say today, I'm going to save for another time. But I'd really like to open it up for Q&A early and hear from you about any part of what I've said today or anything that you just want to bring forward. Because again, for me, I think the Q&A is my favorite part for me. Because yeah, because it's in dialogue. It's one-to-one. Then we go on from there. So, if anyone has any questions. And Shore is going to bring a mic around if anyone does.
Good morning, and thank you. As you were talking at the very end, I started to remember about the monks' walk, the monks who went from Texas to Washington, kind of culminated in them leading basically a mindfulness meditation on the steps of the National Cathedral, which was just, I was like dumbfounded, you know? And I wonder, that's what I wish we could do, something, because there was nothing political, you know, there was, it was a statement they were making of some kind, which was beyond words to me. And it wasn't apolitical. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't political. It wasn't apolitical. They didn't have the signs, you know. But I think it was very inspiring for people and moving, you know. And so that's what our practice is for us, I think. For me, my practice is something, and your practice is something to inspire me to keep going. And I just wondered, I don't know, I'm not saying we should take a walk or something, but I just wish we could do something together that was inspiring like that.
Yeah. And after this, some of us are gonna go take a walk starting at Cal, and yeah, as part of the No Kings. Thank you. I would love to do something like that.
Clay Taylor has his hand up online.
Great. Hi, Clay, and hi, everyone online.
Hi, Linda. Sounds like you can hear me.
I can.
Great. I've been in the room when this discussion has come up a few times, and I realized that for me, the most important thing for my Roshi to do is to reflect the depth and beauty of the practice and to embody the depth and beauty and reflect it back to me and our community.
What has that looked like to you when you see the depth and beauty of our practice reflected?
Well, it's a feeling, and it's about an embodied sensibility. So I think it resonates with what you were saying about embodying the practice in everything that you do. I believe it also has something to do with an inner calm and trust in our way. But as I was thinking about it, really, I think that's why people come to Berkeley Zen Center. Is for that. It's for the practice, and there's something mysterious and deep about it. And that's what I've always loved about practice. And I've been a little bit shy about bringing it up because it's quite intangible, but here I am. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, there's a lot of me that feels very settled and calm right now, but I also feel a little unsettled. There's just been a lot in the last days. And I think that's part of what practice really has to offer, is that, you know, this body awareness that, in a sense, we can be doing two things at one time. You know, can hold ceremony and the forms, you know, and you may have many forms in your life. Some people do Tai Chi or yoga, and just starting into that practice can evoke a whole calmer way of being just in the body. The body is getting messages that things are okay, even though other parts of the body and maybe the mind are going bzzz. And these can coexist. You know, it's not, I don't mean comfortably, exactly, but we can create space for a lot more than we think we can or have. And a lot of that is just body-based practice. I remember realizing that lying on my back with my knees up, like on a chair or on the couch, something about that, like visually looking straight up rather than around, and just feeling the support on my back rather than under my feet, just something started letting go. So that became a touchstone, but everyone has their own. You know, yours might be visual, they might be auditory. Someone recently was talking about like the importance of birds, like listening to birds was kind of like, okay, listen. So, yeah. Thank you, Clay, for bringing that up. Anyone else? Ryushin.
Linda Roshi, thank you very much for your talk today and for giving it today on a Saturday and today at this particular confluence of events. I really appreciate it. I didn't raise my hand to follow up on Lori's comment, but I want to start by just saying for those of you who might be looking for some place to go this afternoon, there are a group of Buddhists who are going to walk peacefully together as Buddhists and chant together and stand together. If that's something that's meaningful to you, you could speak to me or Lori afterwards about where that's happening. So what I wanted to say in response to your question, which I really appreciate, is I started as a Vipassana practitioner a long time ago, and there was something missing in that beautiful practice for me. It was so valuable, but it was missing the Mahayana vow for me. It was missing a call to respond directly to the suffering of the world right now, no matter how imperfect I was. And that really touched my heart deeply. What it's made it possible for me slowly and in a more and more open way to be able to do that effectively is the ground of the teachings that talk about impermanence, that talk about, that root my life in something that's much bigger, much more universal than the particularities that I work in, that we work in any particular time, whether it's my personal suffering or a catastrophe like losing a home or a zendo. One of our revered late teachers here, when asked about this in a how do I do this, she said, Maylee Scott said, don't ever think anything is out of place. It took me years to understand what that really meant in a deep way, but it allows me to see that no matter what happens, it's okay on one level, as Linda was beginning to talk about. It's okay because things just are what they are. What's important is the next thing, which is, what do I do? And that's, I can think of something to do, I can respond because of this practice. And it would be heart-wrenching to me if we did not speak about this practice as a way of opening to the suffering of the world, the first noble truth.
Thank you. Yeah, the okay or the all right or not out of place. You know, if we're hearing that from a more dualistic point of view, then it's then it also implies the judgment that it's okay, that it's all right, that it's happening, which is very separate from this is. It's all right. It's all right. I've come to think of it as, what's all right is I'm fundamentally okay because I can be with this thing that is incredibly painful, hurtful, harmful, whatever it is. I can find the space within myself to let it in and let all the feelings in and let all the thoughts in and find my way forward with it, not being in denial that it's happening, not trying to make it something that it's not. And in the absolute, in non-duality, there it also includes duality. I mean, if non-duality didn't include duality, it would be dualistic. But we don't live in the absolute. I mean, we do periodically, but that's not where we live our lives. So in the place where we live our life, we're holding the view of the absolute and those moments when we touch into that in a very deep way, but to take our, to actually manifest our bodhisattva vows, we cannot put down the discerning mind. The thing, the exact thing that we're trying to put down when we sit, we have to take up when we get off this very safe, contained place of being on the cushion. So being able to put it down and put it back on is quite a skill, because when we're sitting and it's very spacious and it's very open, it's like, I want to stay here forever. This is really good. It's changing. No, it's not. It's not. I can get it back. I was sitting just like this before. I mean, there's so many versions of this, but that's a prescription for suffering, our own and people around us, you know. But we also need discernment, because we can't treat different things in different ways. So, I mean, this is an ongoing koan for me, not to feel it in my body, but to know how to talk about it more skillfully. Yeah, so I get why all the koans are just like, you know, blows and shouts and, you know, putting a shoe on your head and walking out the door, because it's hard to talk about. It's hard to, R.H. Blythe once said, it's not hard to talk about Zen. No, it's not hard to write about Zen. What's hard is to write by Zen. To express from the inside. Although I think poetry and, you know, I mean, there's ways of pointing, but it's always, we're expressing to others. So it's always a dance, it's always an interaction. Even if you're writing and it goes out and you don't know who, you're still somehow imagining who might be reading. And it's always so rewarding when people write back and they say, that really touched me. It's like, oh, we connected. Because that's so much of what we want to do in this life, is to really connect. Oh, thank you. Okay. Linda, Shorey, Jeff, and Michael, and what's your name?
Barack.
Barack. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Well, you're not going to be able to satisfy everybody. So some people want to bring their engagement with the world into this space. And some people, as you said, want to call this space a refuge from all that, even if they're engaged outside. Some people think that to imagine that refuge means shutting out the vast violence and suffering that, for example, we are paying for, is what kind of refuge is that? Some people think that the word political is almost identical with sin. Keep it out of here. So, since you can't satisfy everybody, I hope you, I know you will be aware of the danger of seeking not to offend anybody, ever.
I've tried so hard to do that in my life, and it really hasn't worked. I mean, it's worked better for other people than it has for me, for sure. So I'm really trying to be done with that. When I know where I stand, the discernment is much easier, because it's not clouded by not wanting to offend, disappoint, hurt, have you go away. This is just my expression, and I own it. But I'm also so aware that my expression, my world, myself, is completely interdependent with you and all of you. And that enriches me deeply.
And it's so hard, to comprehend all that and still to find a way to act and speak. So
yeah.
I trust you pretty much.
Thanks. I hope I'm worthy of it, at least some of the time.
Thank you for your talk, Linda Roshi. A phrase I've heard you say before is, have your feelings or they will have you. What is that? What is to have one's feelings, and what is when one's feelings have us? Mm.
I could give you one example before I learned how to have my feelings. Something very, very difficult had happened to me, and I was staying with a friend for several days. And after a few days, this person said, we need to talk about these things that you're doing, which I had no idea what I was doing at all. I had no idea what they were talking about. And my friend said, you know, now I'm getting even more upset that you have no idea what's happening because you're like not in touch. So that's an example. Later, I could have my feelings, which meant they came and went, and they were manifesting in my body and mind and thoughts, and I was getting familiar with them. But if we're not willing to have them, then they kind of have us, and we have no idea how. I will say that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is people who have a lot of feelings and act them out and just keep going with them. So neither end is really great. They just have different variations, and probably the other one might look better if you're in one and want to be more calm to or more open to go to the other. But it means that you're not in relationship with them. I think having your feelings doesn't mean that you own them. It means that you're in some kind of living relationship with the flux of our body, mind, feelings, emotions, as opposed to having them take us over or trying to make them go away. I think it was Jeff, Michael, and Barack.
I wanted to play a little bit off of sort of what Clay said, because what was coming up for me while you were talking, and how do I view your role here, among all of the ways I view your role, is that when I come to practice, I create a container around myself inside of which I practice. And I do all of the things that practice does. I breathe, and I see, and all of the other manifestations of that practice. We create a container together, and that is the Sangha. And then we move, sometimes 1,000 hands, each with an eye, knowing instinctively what to do. Sometimes not, just seeking refuge from the uncomfortable or the trials of the world. One of the things I look to you for is to anchor who we are together. Because in that quiet space, when we're practicing together, and we don't say, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that, we find that place inside, and we touch that practice place inside that holds the absolute and the phenomenal from which behavior arises. I can come in and be thoroughly confused about who I am, what I want, and what I'm going to do, and just by settling and being together, something else happens. When I first came in, I wanted to live in the absolute. I never wanted to come back to the phenomenal. And it was a painful lesson to figure out you can't do that. But in the absolute, there is some guidance. And somewhere in that mystery is how we hold that it's all right and that it's not all right in the same hand. I thank you for what you do, because I find those things in you, and I'm grateful.
Thank you, Jeff. I want to say that I've also, I feel so held by the whole Sangha. I mean, all of you make me and allow me to do what I do. It's, yeah. There's two more people. There's three more people. What? Is it a question? Okay, then there are several people ahead of you, but I'll take you next. Okay, if we get that far. Michael.
Thank you, Roshi. I think with everything that's come up, whether it's the fire in the Zendo, the tragedy that we're all facing and having to know kings for, it really seems to beg us to pay attention to the immediacy of practice. It's almost as if life has kind of taken its arm and swept everything off the table. It's like, here, this is happening. There's no time for frivolousness. And I've also been thinking lately, too, that things like philosophy or even theology are just, they're a privilege of people who have time or who have full stomachs. What I keep coming back to, and I do have a point, I promise. What I keep coming back to is I hear refuge from a lot of the comments and questions in your talk. And I really like Dr. Alexander Berzin in the Tibetan tradition translates refuge as safe direction. And for me, safe direction is vow. It's the bodhisattva vow. It's the vow to live and be lived for the benefit of all beings. And that to me seems like if we can hold vow during the times and places when we do have that privilege, we can think of frivolous things, we can care about what's on TV or how our hair looks, then we have the muscle memory of that vow during the tough places. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you. Barak.
Thank you for your talk, Linda Roshi. I'm a newcomer to this sangha. I've been coming for a few weeks, and I just wanted to express my gratitude for the teachers here and to name that for me personally, coming here is a place of refuge. It's been really impactful to hear the link made explicit to what's happening in the world and what's happening in the Zendo. One of the ways I consider practices as an act of witnessing, like collective witness, collective being. And I think to meet everything that's going on in the world through and with a community of people who are engaged has just been really meaningful. So I want to say thank you to the collective container of the Sangha.
We have a question online. Karen, hello.
Hi, Linda. And everybody, nice to see you. I can't even remember what I was going to ask because I've been so engrossed in what I'm hearing. It's been really a lively conversation in a really positive way. What was coming up for me when you were talking earlier about just there being a lot and not being able to kind of have it all in the same place at the same time, it made me think of the mirror samadhi, like a massive fire, don't touch it. Don't turn away.
Turning away and touching are both wrong because it is like a massive fire.
Yeah.
That one. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was something I heard when I first came into my practice 15 years ago when I was dealing with some suffering, like we all deal with suffering. But that just, it keeps coming back to me for the past 15 years and most prominently right now. So thank you. Thank you for your leadership.
Thank you. What came up for me as you were bringing that up was how do we sit in the middle of the fire? Not to touch it, not to turn away, but to sit in the middle of it and both let it burn us up completely and also remain untouched in the deeper sense, not to try to be untouched, but to burn and be incombustible at the same time. Yeah. There are many, many metaphors for finding our way through this, at first very narrow space and that then widens out through practice of being able to touch more regularly and more deeply through a whole wide range of experiences. Let's see, Jeremiah, and oh no, we still have a little bit of time. Great.
Thank you for your talk. I wanted to say that, you know, I have found myself in different places relative to this conversation. You know, like what was I seeking when I came here? And in the beginning, it was definitely about refuge, although I used the word oasis in the beginning. And it was a way for me to get away from everything that was super uncomfortable and like causing me to cry in unpredictable situations and ways. And yeah, this place was absolutely a way to get away from all of that. And, you know, I would like sit and just like cry a little bit in here, you know. And I remember maybe a couple weeks ago, I heard someone else's tears and I thought, are those my, am I crying? And I was like, no, it's not me. That's somebody else. You know, it became like a way for me to get away from everything. And I just valued coming in the gate and like bowing to someone and having that, like, not even have to say anything to communicate. That was, felt great to me. And then it becoming more of like a place for me to try and figure out how to sit zazen when I'm not here, without even crossing my legs, when I'm at work or I'm home or I'm whatever. Like, how can I bring my mind to where my body is no matter what I'm doing all day long? You know, so it became more like a way to think about that. So I've moved, you know, and I think like it's impossible to escape politics. Like this clock is political. You know, the porridge we had this morning is political. Like, we can't really escape politics, but I know what people are talking about. You know, they don't want to be hit over the head with someone else's politics. I think that, like, you can take people who have different affinity groups and find things they all agree on, like love and compassion. I think, you know, no matter what affinity group you belong to, love and compassion is probably a core idea for you. And the last thing I'll say is that I love to be kept off balance. So coming here has exposed me to teachers. And I've spent a long time, you know, a few decades, like people coming to me and asking me questions. And I really love the ability to talk to someone and have them keep me off balance. Like, not tell me what they think I want to hear, but telling me how to loosen my grip on something when I didn't even know I was tightening it.
Thank you. One thing I just want to mention from the body point of view and body practice, Master Sheng Yan, a Chan teacher, Chinese Chan teacher, someone asked him, I think, what is like lay practice, or what is practice for a lay person? And he said, regulate your life. And I've been thinking about that a lot, and how with so much more going on, so much more input, like regulating my life and priorities has become really key, but also regulating our bodies. And that's that kind of information is really out there in the world right now. If you haven't encountered, you know, what's available about the vagus nerve and how to calm your nervous system down. You know, just type in regulate my nervous system and you'll get very helpful things. One of the most simple, helpful things is what's called the window of tolerance, which looks like, you know, one of those bell curves. And in the middle is where practice is actually possible. This is why I'm saying this. Somewhere in the middle is where practice is actually possible. When we're in overwhelm or freak out, basically our practice is trying to get back to a place where we can engage in practice more deeply. We're just trying to hold on. We're trying to not make it worse. That's a big deal. When we're feeling in those really intense states, to not make it worse. That's enough for the moment. Don't feed it. Don't go find your best friend who's going to tell you everything that you want to hear in this moment. Go find that other friend who might throw you a little off balance or support you in different ways. Whatever it is, you're trying to get back from overwhelm, and you're also trying to get back from shutdown and depression and that overwhelming fatigue. Neither one of those are so conducive to practice. So your practice is just to try to come back in the middle. And the body and the nervous system is such a big part of that. Your thoughts can help you, but your thoughts are often running amok when your body's in revolt. So the more you can just take care of the body, the more it can help your mind as well. Marie.
I read something recently about that that I found very helpful and that I felt in a way kind of synthesized or summarized practice for me in those difficult moments. And it talked about the difference between experiencing something as a threat versus experiencing it as a challenge. And to really understand what is challenging me right now. And that shifted a lot for me. That when I can take something that feels, when I realize I'm feeling threatened, and why, and then transform it into how can I see this as a challenge, and understanding what is my personal challenge in this. Mm. And it's been really useful, and I think that is also what practice does, at least for me.
Thank you. And we're at time. Thank you so much for being here and for listening and for your questions and your comments. I always learn so much in so many ways. Thank you.
Beings are numberless. I vow to awaken with them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow.